Unfortunately, there is a war that has been going on for 2 years in Ukraine. It was on November 23rd, 2013, when our former president, who is now in Russia, didn't sign association agreement with European Union. And it was when people came on the streets, students first, and then they were beaten, hardly beaten by police. And next day, their parents came, their grandparents came, many other students came. So we were there at the central square in Kyiv, protesting against the government decision. We wanted to change policies. We wanted to change a future for the country. We paid a lot of price for this, a lot of sacrifices. Many people were killed at Maidan. But still we won. The president escaped and we got a new government, a new president. We were ready to wait for a change, but there was one thing that we were not ready for. We were not ready for a war with Russia.
How much discontent was there before that event? I mean, was this building up slowly?
There were a lot of conversations about European integration and association. And there was even a referendum and a lot of, you know, opinion polls conducted in the country. And it was clear that majority of population wanted to join. Because for all of us, it meant different values. It meant less corruption in the country. It meant new quality of decision making. Things that we call values. And didn't happen. And that's why we basically came on the streets and started protesting.
Who were the people that came together for this protest? Was this a coalition of many different kinds of groups?
Oh, they were just ordinary people, different generations, youth. For example, my family, I was there, my kids were there, and my parents were there. And each of us had its own, his or her own Maidan. The reasons why we came there, what united us was that we had one joint idea about the change in our country. So this is what brought us in there in November 23rd, and this is what kept us during the whole winter there.
People who were wanting to join with the European Union, did they feel that there would be more democracy in the country and more economic progress?
Yes, absolutely. We were expecting that there will be more democracy, exactly. There will be less corruption. There will be more respect to human rights. There will be economic development. We knew that it will not start immediately, but of course it didn't. There are some changes now. Clearly, we see that civil society in Ukraine has a real power. Civil society can influence on decisions that are made in the country. So this is about democracy. We are changing people in the government now. We are fighting corruption, which is not an easy thing to do, of course, because it's deeply rooted in the culture. But still, there are some successes. The challenge, though, is economic situation in the country. Because of the war, there is basically an economic crisis. There is a huge inflation, more than 40% inflation in the country. And the exchange rate for the national currency went, for dollar, it was 8 hryvnias, which is a local currency for $1. And in 2 months, it went to 24 hryvnias per $1.
This is during the conflict with Russia that made things worse, right?
Right, right. The conflict and basically war. We call it war with Russia because clearly it's war.
You said that people didn't really expect that element in the resistance. Was everyone surprised that Russia invaded Ukraine?
Yes, we were surprised with Crimea when it happened in Crimea. And then when they moved further to the east, to Donetsk and Luhansk, we were not prepared. You know, the country at that time didn't have any systems to react. There was no army, basically, at all. So, and this is when civil society again mobilized. And at that time also, when the war started, they started killing people. Presently, we have almost 1.5 million internally displaced people in the country. Those who basically fled from their regions, from their homes, they left everything there because, you know, it was not safe for them to stay there. So this is what we're not prepared for as well.
What was the relationship before the conflict with Russia?
Well, we were part of the Soviet Union for 70 plus years. Then we got independence in 1991, all 15 republics which were members of the Soviet Union. But This independence we got only on paper 25 years ago, and only now we are getting real independence. And many people say that, you know, especially Russian propaganda is talking a lot about this, that they are protecting Russian-speaking population in Ukraine. Indeed, there are a lot of people who speak Russian. I speak Russian also. So what, it has never been a problem for me, like for many other people, for my family, for my parents who speak Russian, for my neighbors. So it's not a real problem. I think the problem is the dreams to come back to reorganize the old empire of some leaders. This is what is really dangerous.
So do you feel that Russia was afraid that Ukraine was getting too independent before they came in?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
In Russia, who would gain by having more control in the Ukraine? Who benefits by this conflict?
Oh, definitely there are a lot of people who benefit, but they are mostly in decision-making. I'm sure Russian population, although they keep hearing the news, again, this Russian KGB-style propaganda, they keep hearing the news that, you know, this is for the benefit of Russia. But I believe only those who are in power, there are many people who are making money in Russia on this war, on this conflict. They think that situation in Ukraine is dangerous for them, also in terms of their own country and civil society development there, because we are showing a good example for the other countries. Like the other day, I had a meeting with a human rights activist from Russia, and we discussed the law, so-called law on foreign agents. They adopted this law in Russia, and basically the law is the instrument to kill civil society. Every civil society organization has to pass through a registration, a new registration, and if the organization is getting funding from abroad, it has to register as foreign agent. And in Russian, it means that you are a spy. In public perception, it has always been like, you know, foreign agent is something really bad. With the previous Ukrainian government 2 years ago, they also wanted to pass similar law in Ukraine. It was during the revolution, and this was the moment when more people came on Maidan, on the main square, to protest. They passed this law, and it existed for not more than 2 weeks, and then they canceled it. So I do think Russia sees, you know, developments in Ukraine, and the role that civil society is playing also is a danger for them.
Democracy is a thing that can catch on, and yes, it is very catchy, almost like a cold, huh? And that's dangerous for control. When did Russia pass the legislation about registering nonprofits that way?
I think it was 3 or 4 years ago.
So you perceive Russia as having a gradual wanting more and more control, both back in Russia as well as with the countries that can influence them?
Of course. I do think they want a control in the whole region. They basically want to rebuild the old empire.
All right, so now we're chronologically up to when the protests were. Explain that day when you were protesting and when it got started. How many people were there and what did you see?
I was in Lithuania, where their summit of European leaders was taking place. So we were protesting there, actually. By the time we came to Lithuania, we knew that our president is not going to sign this association agreement. So together with other leaders of civil society organizations, we were protesting there in Lithuania, hoping that he would change his opinion. Of course, it didn't happen. But at the same time, in Ukraine, students went on the streets protesting. There were around 200, I think, students who stood on Maidan, the central square, and they decided to stay. They had tents, and they decided to stay there until he changes his opinion, the president. And what happened the next night was that police came in at 3 or 4 in the morning and started beating them. They were running, you know, trying to escape. Of course, nobody expected this. And there is a church near this central square, near Maidan, that basically let them in during the night and closed the door so that police was not able to get there. And what they started to do in the morning is that they started to ring the bells, almost like in the ancient times. And people heard these bells. Also, there was a lot of information in social media, because that was not under government control, of course. People started to write each other saying that, you know, the students were beaten and we have to do something. And I do remember by that time I was in Kyiv already. And I remembered huge, huge crowds of people coming to Maidan, coming to the central square, because they wanted to support the development.
So what happened after that?
Well, after that, there were more people who were coming on Maidan. We started to organize. There was this system of so-called hundreds developed. Again, like in the old times, people, in order to better organize, people started to organize themselves in hundreds based on either regional principle, like there was a hundred from one specific region. There were hundreds of people who were doing, who had cars. If there was a need for people who have cars, then there was this hundred of people who have cars. There was a women's hundred as well. It was composed by women who were at Maidan and who thought that they could do much more than just cleaning and cooking, because at Maidan, the same old gender stereotypes, we saw them there as well. There were these messages on the everywhere saying that women, if you see garbage, just go and clean. And there were women who didn't agree with this, and they formed their own hundred. There were women lawyers there, women of different professions. And we were also helping there. We were helping to protect the rights of those who were kept by police. There were women doctors who were providing medical assistance for those who were injured at Maidan. So doing different things. And, well, it was at the beginning, but then when the things became worse, when they started shooting people in February. It lasted actually from November 23 till the middle, almost the end of February, so during the whole winter. We were staying there, we were collecting food, collecting clothes for people, raising money for them to support them. And then in February they started shooting. And we were also there. I was there at that night when they killed more than 100 people. I will never forget this, of course. And but they were thinking that when they start shooting people, people will get afraid and we will leave and we will give up. But we didn't. And this is how we won.
Were people expecting the violence eventually?
Oh no, of course, never. Never. Ukraine is a peaceful country. We had protests before, but they were never violent. No. This was for the first time when they were basically killing people.
These organizations that came together, you call them hundreds?
Mm-hmm. Hundreds. They are composed of hundreds of people.
I love it. That's great. We could use that here. So the women's organizations, was there a fear that with this increased repression coming from Russia influencing the Ukraine, that women's lives would be worse?
Well, we didn't think about this at that time. We just thought that, you know, women definitely know their role in all these processes. They know what to do and they want to support all the developments. Well, about women's role in general, this regime killed women's movement in just a couple of years by introducing policies that do not allow organizations to work, by threatening the leaders of civil society, including women's rights organizations. And in Russia, it was one of the most progressive women's movements in the countries of former Soviet Union. They killed this movement in just a couple of years. It started in 2004 or 5. I know several leaders of women's movement in Russia who are now doing completely different things.
So you saw what was happening in Russia and then feared that that would come to Ukraine, and indeed, you're right.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And, you know, our leaders also, we saw that our leadership has really strong connections with Russian leaders. So basically they were copying, sharing a lot of strategies and ideas with Russia. And at some point we had feelings even that these are not their ideas. These are not Ukrainian government ideas.
So before the protests, were people intermarried and there were inner neighborhoods of Russian speakers versus non-Russian speakers? Was everything completely integrated before the protests started?
Absolutely. We never had, you know, problems with that. Although Ukraine, well, the specifics of the country is that we do have regional differences. The center is bilingual. Well, actually, the whole country is bilingual. If you speak Russian in Lviv, which is in Western Ukraine, people will answer you in Russian. If you speak in Donetsk, which is in the east, in Ukrainian, will be happy that you are talking to them in Ukrainian. Some will answer you in Russian, but it's not a problem at all.
So Kyiv being a major capital, you had Russian speakers and Ukrainian speakers, and within the city, it was very cosmopolitan?
Absolutely, absolutely. Like me, I don't even pay attention which language I'm using. I'm switching from Russian to Ukrainian, and if you ask me then which language I used, I don't know. I don't pay attention.
Has that changed now in the last 2 years?
I think there are more people who speak Ukrainian because this is the way for them to show that they do not give up, that they want to be an independent country. Both younger generation and older generation as well.
All right, so then in February, everything changed in a sense. Did it make people more resolved to defend the Ukraine after the violence in February? And if so, then how did the structures change?
Well, basically after violence, people thought that they would continue staying in at Maidan, although it was really, really, really dangerous for them. We decided that we would continue staying there until we win. And this was, I think, the moment when the government got afraid and our president. So he basically packed and left the country. And there is also a famous story about how rich he was. He has stolen basically, I don't know, 25% of the state budget or so. This is ridiculous. I mean, after the Maidan won, they opened his house for public, and you cannot even call this place a house, it's a palace. And there was also, you know, we saw some video materials about how he was escaping, how he was running to Russia. There were like several helicopters full of different stuff that he was, I assume, money and everything that he was bringing to Russia. Yeah.
And he remains there now?
Oh, he is there now. From time to time, he organizes press conferences saying that, you know, how bad is everything in Ukraine. And, you know, that it is not fair and all the other things. But, yeah, he's safe there, probably spending his money that he has stolen from the country.
Tell me about your new president. And how long was there before you had a new president?
There was no one leader. Versus in 2004, when we had revolution, also which was called Orange Revolution, people came on the streets to protest against the results of elections, presidential elections, which were falsified. At that time, there was one leader that, you know, that definitely clearly got more votes, but election committee falsified everything. People knew this, and that is why we came. So this time we knew that there was no one leader. There was just a wish to change the system for us. So after Maidan won, their new elections were announced. We still had old parliament, but the parliament announced elections for president. And one of those people who were at Maidan participating actively, people voted for him, Petro Poroshenko. He was the member of parliament at that time. He got more than 60% of votes.
And you feel these were fairly counted?
Yes, absolutely.
Describe Kyiv and how it feels different now than it was 2 years ago.
I think it's different. It's more freedom now. It's more fresh air. There are more young people who are on the streets who are expressing themselves. But also, it is this feeling of danger that we feel these days after the war started. It is this feeling that we should always be careful about everything, because we don't know, we are afraid that Russia will not let it go like it is. Definitely they continue killing people in the east, and every day from 5 to 15 people die. No matter that officially it is a ceasefire announced, still they are killing people, and we are afraid of their terroristic attacks in the big cities. So in addition to this feeling of freedom, which is on one side, on the other side there is this fear of terrorism.
Describe when the Russians attacked.
Well, it was a time, I think, when we all learned, when we started, you know, new habits. We started to get to sleep reading the news, and the first thing that we were doing in the morning, we were reading the news again. And every day the news were about more and more people killed and more people leaving their territories and becoming IDPs, internally displaced people. After the Crimea invasion, many of us knew that this might happen, but still for many of us it was really unexpected. I mean, living in one country with Russia, having all these historical roots, having relatives in Russia, many of us, to imagine that they will start killing us, they will start taking our land at some point. Of course, who can believe in this?
Where are most of the internally displaced people now?
Majority of them are in the border regions.
So they've moved from the very, very eastern portion. Slowly they're moving west.
Slowly to the west. Basically, there is a lack in supportive mechanisms in the government. For example, and we have staff member at the Ukrainian Women's Fund who was based in Donetsk. And basically, during one night, he had to run from her hometown, from her apartment, with 3 weeks old daughter. And now she lives with relatives in the west, 200 kilometers from Kyiv, in a small tiny village, for almost a year and a half already. She is an example of many other IDPs who in many cases are left on their own in this situation, because we do not have camps, for example, where they live. The government is not providing housing. The only thing that they are getting is a small subsidy to pay for housing, basically to rent an apartment, which is not enough to rent an apartment, of course. So IDPs have to work, have to find jobs, which is also a challenge in the country, which is facing economic problems, serious, deep economic problems. There are a lot of challenges. In some cases, for example, the whole Donetsk University was moved to the city towards the west of Ukraine called Vinnytsia. And it's a serious challenge for the infrastructure there in this city as well. Just imagine that you have to leave everything that you had and go somewhere, you don't know where, do something, you don't know what you are going to do, and basically start a new life.
And you don't know for how long you're going to be displaced, or will you have the ability to go back?
Absolutely. Well, now with the ceasefire, we see that some people are moving back to Donetsk and Luhansk Oblast. But this is the question. I do think that, unfortunately, the war is not going to end soon. With people being killed every day. By the way, Moscow pro-Russian rebels, they became more active clearly when the events in Paris took place. It was obvious, it was like visible in the country. That's why I think, well, everything is connected. The situation in Ukraine is connected to the global situation, and there is no safe place, unfortunately, now in the world. And what is considered local problem is actually part of the global one.
How did people react to what went on in Paris, and how do they draw that connection with home?
Oh, there were, well, first of all, because we experienced this in Ukraine, we know, unfortunately, what terrorism is, and we are every day we are prepared for similar situations in Kyiv. I remember even from my childhood, I grew up in the Soviet Union. I was born in the Soviet Union. There was always this threat of, you know, America, and there was always this competition between Soviet Union and America. And I remember there were these signs on the buildings which said the directions to shelters. If there is an attack, where the shelter is. Now we have these signs in Kyiv. So people are really kind of preparing that it's going to last for a long time, and it's not, unfortunately, it might get worse. So when we saw what's happening in Paris, there were many people who were coming to the French embassy in Ukraine, bringing flowers, bringing candles, because we know what is terrorism and because we know what is war.
The signs for the shelter locations, are they in Ukraine and Russian or just Ukrainian?
To tell you the truth, I didn't pay attention. This is again will be about languages. I don't know.
For you folks, the terrorists are Russian inspired, shall we say? I mean, who are they? Are they from Syria? Are they from other countries?
We think they are Russian inspired. Moreover, they are paid by Russia and they are trained by Russia.
Natalia, I wanted to ask you about Ukraine's future. Do you think civil society will be strong enough to resist these repressive influences from religious extremism and Russia?
Well, I think there is just no way back for us. We should, because, well thinking about how much we went through, how many people died, what are the sacrifices that we paid for this, of course there is no way back. Yeah, we will continue working as we do now, 24/7, helping those who are in need, pushing government to be more active in reforming the country, in developing new policies, and hopefully we will win. I don't know when. I don't know when the war is going to end and how it's going to end, but we are hoping that it will end soon, and the new life will begin. We'll start building the new country.